Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome back to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 296, I have the pleasure of being joined by two of my colleagues for a discussion of the June 2021 issue of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician is published in print and online at retinalphysician.com, and we preview three of the articles from this edition, including an article discussing tips and tricks for the port delivery system, anti-VEGF and PRP protocol S data for proliferative diabetic retinopathy, and loss to follow-up after anti-VEGF for AMD and diabetic retinopathy. As always, you can find a list of financial disclosures in the episode description. You can also find a link to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website and claim CME credit for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a preview of the June 2021 edition of Retinal Physician. Joining me for this, first on the East Coast, Dr. M. Ali Khan. Ali, welcome.
Thanks, Jay. Good to be back.
And next, joining me from the far, far, far West Coast, Dr. Sarah Reed from Honolulu, Hawaii.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me.
We are not releasing the video, but Sarah has an amazing background of her place. I have not seen it yet, and I'm very excited. Oh, man, it looks so green outside. Look at all that natural lighting. Ali would be jealous.
Well, it's also 3 o'clock. That helps.
Let's not rub it in too much. Let's talk about anti-VEGF and PDR and DR. So the first Retinal Physician article, and remember, all these articles are found online at retinalphysician.com if you want to read the whole thing, is loss to follow-up after anti-VEGF for age-related macular degeneration and diabetic retinopathy. This is an article by Salabadi, Suarez, and Chu out of Wills. And again, our goal here is not to just recap the article. These are articles that you can go and read on your own, but they kind of reference their previous work done at Wills, talking about loss to follow-up and how this is an issue in both these conditions that a lot of times do require not only follow-up, but treatment with anti-VEGF injection. They talk about how it impacted patients with AMD. Those patients who got lost to follow-up generally don't recover back to the same degree as vision as their cohorts who do not miss time to loss of follow-up. And same thing for PDR, there is an issue. And again, this is only capturing the patients who came back, but even in the patients who came back, they tend to have worse outcomes when they do come back with gaps. And so this is actually relevant in the context of COVID-19. We've talked about this a couple of times. They talked through some strategies to reduce loss to follow-up. Maybe you can have ways to do home monitoring. Maybe there are ways to track these patients or call them if they miss their appointment, and different setups have different ways of doing this. And I'll ask you both kind of how you do that. And I think it's also relevant that there's a socioeconomic and unfortunately racial component to this, an ethnic component, where there is a greater loss to follow-up depending on zip code and depending on socioeconomic groups. And maybe that some of this could be cultural or economic barriers. What can we do to kind of address those as a field? So Sarah, I'll let you start because our demographics between our three locations are very different. What does your practice do for loss to follow-up? Do you do anything in particular for patients that you think are higher risk, or how do you kind of categorize in your head, oh, this patient's higher risk, we may lose them? And do you have a standard approach where if a patient misses an appointment, you call them? If they don't respond to a call, do you send them a letter? Like, what do you guys do as a practice? And then do you do anything in particular for certain patients?
So that's a great question. So we normally do 2 telephone calls for a missed patient and then a letter if we don't get a response after that. For patients who decline follow-up, that gets written down and I have to actually sign off on it. So if it turns out that it's a patient for whom, an example would be, I had a recent patient who had some early changes that were concerning for plaquenil toxicity who had declined to follow up. And so that's a patient that I personally called and also called their PCP to sort of close the loop. I don't normally do that, but there are a few conditions where if I'm especially concerned, I'll actually call myself. But yeah, we do phone calls initially and then a letter if those phone calls don't result in an appointment.
Ali, this study and all of these studies came out of Wills, where you're at with Jason Hsu. What do you guys do typically at MAR? And did it change with the study results? I'm curious, was there any sort of internal change in policies? Is there a standard policy for all the retina docs, or does everyone kind of do something on their own?
Yeah, so similar to what Sarah was mentioning, we do have a standard policy. The only thing we changed was that there's a little bit of a different policy now for people who are on active treatment versus people who are, you know, missing their once a year follow-up for screening that had been previously treated. But if they're active treatment, we do the phone calls, two of them, like Sarah mentioned, and then send a letter. But we actually now have a team that's more actively checking up on these people after that standard protocol if we were not able to get a hold of them. And that was because of these studies, simply because of, you know, what you summarized in the article, that, you know, the outcomes definitely are, can be poor in some of these cases. And again, we're only seeing the people who did indeed come back. So we've now altered our approach to kind of even more fervently try to track down the people who are on active treatment. That was kind of the main change. But, you know, shout out to Anthony Obeid, first year Will's resident, the number one residency program in the country. Sorry to the two Bascom folks on here, but he spearheaded a lot of the work on this. And I think, you know, there's still more that we can learn from each other's practices and different settings about, you know, good ways to keep people, you know, being seen, particularly those that, similar to these studies, have poor outcomes if we lose them.
It's a good thing we can edit these podcasts. I think Ali is trying to guarantee his retirement. You know, I always had a rule that we might be breaking this summer, that once you hit 5 years, you get voted off the podcast since you're no longer considered young. Ali, you may have just guaranteed that you'll be the first example with that comment. So I don't even know where to go now. I'm just so frazzled and discombobulated. I missed everything else he said after that. Sarah, let's leave that aside and let's move forward, because that's what residents from the number one training program in the country do, is they take the high road. You know, so what about liability, right? This isn't necessarily my biggest concern, but this is something people talk about. And both of you referenced the idea of the documentation of those phone calls, the letter, and the patient has to, if they do decline follow-up, you have to sign off it. And a lot of that is actually legal documentation, right? Because these patients do have worse outcomes. And if they come back, there needs to be shown efforts that you tried to make sure they kept coming back, or you tried to get them in, because they could be turned around. So, you know, the patient didn't understand the severity of this. They don't know. You're the physician and you're the one who should have gotten them in. And I'm not saying I agree with that stance, but I think from a legal standpoint, that argument has been posed in different malpractice suits. So from a legal standpoint, I wonder, does your practice have any policy for patients who repeatedly are lost to follow-up, or if they're lost to follow-up for a long enough period of time, how do you handle that situation? Let's say if they declined follow-up and you signed off, do doctors in your practice ever release patients if they don't show up to appointments and they're high risk? If not, if they come back, does that affect your ability to take care of them? I'm just curious about these things. You know, I'm at an academic institution where I feel like people just kind of wander in whenever they want. And I don't know if that's the same sort of thing in every practice.
You know, I found that for the most part, especially for both these diseases, diabetes and macular degeneration, for different reasons, often the reasons why patients don't follow up are outside of their control. Often it's for comorbid hospitalizations. They aren't able to get a ride with COVID-19, they weren't allowed to leave their nursing home. So there are a lot of reasons. I usually don't mark that against the patient. I do document, obviously, that they didn't come in and that we had tried to reach them and to schedule them. But that wouldn't be a reason that I wouldn't resume care with the patient, even if I knew that they may not follow up. It may change how I treat them. You know, I may be more prone to aggressive PRP or something like that, as opposed to treating with injections. But no, I wouldn't terminate care because of that. I think the only reason we've done that is somebody who's, you know, abusive to the staff or something like that is the time.
Yeah, and Ali, taking that one step further, and I would agree with Sarah. And again, I think every setup and environment is different. What about patients who, you know, aren't going to follow up from the standpoint? They come for a second opinion, a third opinion, and they're there. And PRP, you can argue, is permanent therapy, but I'm talking about, let's say, injections for AMD or DME. Do you inject those patients? You know, if they're not going to follow up, do you choose to refer them for that injection for wherever they're going to follow up? What's your stance on that? And again, does your practice kind of have a standard approach to it?
Yeah, I don't think we have, you know, kind of this second opinion type of question, or for people who are there, you know, clearly for only a brief period of time. There's not, I think each doctor, you know, kind of chooses their own path. But, you know, if they're coming truly for a second opinion and I agree with the treatment recommendations, I will send them back to whoever they saw first and said, you know, I agree, you can go ahead and start treatment there. rather than, you know, do one single injection and tell them to go off. I think that's just simply, you know, just in case something were to happen, I would want them to sort of be available to get back to the person that they're actually planning to follow up on. And, you know, I think for most of these conditions, there is, you know, a window that you can, you know, safely say, okay, come back and get treated. If they're unable to see somebody else, that's a little different story. Or if there's something kind of more severe going on, like a submacular hemorrhage or something, you know, more urgent, then I will try to keep that patient with me rather than sending them back out. But I think, you know, each doctor does it on a case by case basis. You know, kind of to what a few of Sarah's points, you know, we also don't necessarily terminate people if they, if, you know, a reason for not being able to get back to us. But, you know, we will send certified letters after our original letter, to your point, Jay, to prove that we were trying to find them. And we actually have, you know, a few patients that have been coming and going so much and losing vision and clearly understand why they're losing vision, but seem to be, you know, accusatory to us, even though we've done our best efforts. And I think in those cases, it is reasonable to consider, you know, terminating a relationship with a patient for the purposes of non-compliance with treatment. So I think, you know, most patients that doesn't apply to, but a few diabetics have come to mind that, you know, could fit that profile.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Sarah.
Oh, just to that point, we do have some patients here that are very clearly only going to get short periods of treatment. They're coming from Guam or from the Philippines. And so they're here just to sort of be seen and then they are going back. And so those are patients where I will be more aggressive with laser, either PDT laser and AMD, or, and I'll inject for as long as they're here, but, and then sometimes I'll do light PRP laser for very severe NPDR, things like that. So sort of trying to get whatever treatment I can that's going to be as long lasting as possible in a short period of time for patients who just really can't come back.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was going to make the same point, Sarah. I think we're both kind of on opposite sides of the country, and we both face the same issue where we have patients coming from areas that they don't get access. And so then you have to sort of bend the rules, right? I think anyone would ever offer PDT for wet AMD, but if they're coming from somewhere where they can't get intravitreal injections, well, it's probably, the studies from pre and Teva Jeff show, it may be better than not doing anything, especially you probably see a substantial component of them who are actually PCV as well. Yeah. And so that maybe tips the balance toward doing PDT. And the same thing for injections, like you see a PDR patient, and we're going to get into now the next article, anti-VEGF and PRP, but like that's a very obvious situation where you're going to opt for PRP over anti-VEGF if you know that they aren't going to be able to do treatment, if they aren't going to be able to come back. That really lowers the threshold to do PRP versus anti-VEGF. But let's tie this in the next article, which is anti-VEGF and panretinal photocoagulation for proliferative diabetic retinopathy by Patil, Azad, and Parikh. And again, this is, again, we've discussed protocol S at length. Just to recap for listeners, DRCR protocol, net protocol S, this was a study that looked at ranibizumab versus PRP for the treatment of proliferative diabetic retinopathy and showed that ranibizumab was non-inferior in terms of visual acuity outcomes and regression of neovascularization. Now, there were some differences as you follow these patients out, the five-year results, which we covered in the podcast, you know, the visual field differences between the groups, they still existed, but actually there was visual field loss in the injection group over years, which is interesting. And there was a very high attrition rate, which is one of our biggest dilemmas with diabetic retinopathies. We actually, a lot of these patients never followed up at 5 years. And so it's really a question of what happened to those patients. But they go through the study, they go through what happened with the patients with DME, patients without DME. They talk a little bit about Clarity, which was a similar study looking at aflibercept versus PRP. And we've talked about Clarity here as well. And they just talk about little things like, are there differences between agents? No one really knows for PDR. It's never really been studied, although we have the data for DME from protocol T. And again, I think this is, we go around talking about this a lot, and we just started talking about it, Sarah, when we're talking about follow-ability, but I think all three of us are on board. We're probably doing PRP for most of our patients, but Ali, I'll bring you in here. I mean, I remember one of the things we used to talk about in fellowship that was borne out in this trials was the combo therapy idea of using anti-VEGF early. If they do have good vision and PDR, is there value to adding anti-VEGF? There's other studies like Proteus that show combo therapy may be superior to PRP alone. And I think these studies at least confirm that anti-VEGF is helpful and can treat PDR. I just don't know if any of us are using it in monotherapy in most of our patients at this point, but I don't know what your thoughts are. And again, how it's evolved since we first had that conversation probably 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, I think you know, this might be one of my last podcast episodes because I'm going to age out for that last comment. But I think our discussions back in fellowship, I think, still hold true. I think back then we were saying, hey, we will maybe treat with a few injections just to get somebody to calm down, per se, with the disease, and then add the PRP laser later. And that's actually what I do now. So I think it's a no-brainer when they already have DME. You just start with the anti-VEGF. The real question comes in for the people without DME. Do you go straight to laser or do you try the injections? And those are fewer and far between, I find, of just plain old PDR or severe NPDR with high characteristics without any DME that come across. And those are the people that I have this discussion with. But I try to just get a sense for the patient now. If I feel like they're going to have laser and never show up because they just really weren't prepared to have that laser, then, you know, I'll talk them through it, give them an injection or two to kind of build a relationship and then go to the laser. And vice versa, if I think this person, no matter what I do, is just not going to come back because they're not going to follow up with either of these treatments, I might err towards laser for the long-term effect. So I try to get a sense for the patient, which is not an exact science, of course, but I think with DME, I always start with anti-VEGF. Without DME, that's when the discussion happens, but I've erred towards our prior discussion of a few anti-VEGF to get started before the PRP laser, and just don't do as dense PRP as maybe we learned as residents.
Yeah, and Sarah, I'm gonna get your thoughts here too. I mean, I stagger. I don't necessarily wait that long unless there's a bad view and the media is poor. I still like to do it early, but a lot of times if they can't do them all, it all depends on the patient. Like, I'll have patients who will wanna do one eye one day and then the other another day, then I'll inject in laser, inject laser. Sometimes I'll break up the injections and the laser. Sometimes I'll do, like, I had one patient who she was like, you can inject one eye and do laser in the other eye and then switch it around. And so we do that. I mean, I think it can be tailored. I just don't like big gaps because I think then you get into territory where people just disappear. And as much as we talked about in the last conversation about tracking them, it's hard sometimes to track some of these patients down. Sarah, your thoughts on this issue, and I'm going to bring in a separate issue which wasn't discussed in this article but was in the original protocol S paper, which is interesting. They talked in that paper about differences between argon and like scatter and a pattern scanning laser, like a Pascal laser. And I remember one of the sub analyses from protocol S was like, actually argon laser did better than the pattern scanning laser. And a lot of that, in my personal view, has to do with the parameters that are recommended. You know, we've talked about this before, but like, I go well above the manufacturer's recommendations for pattern scanning in terms of spot size and the power. And that probably achieves potentially, though we don't know for sure, a similar effect to argon burns. But does that influence the type of PRP you do? I mean, do you guys have access to multiple wavelengths? I mean, do you have any sort of pattern that you prefer for how you do your PRP, slit lamp or LIO?
So I would say, first off, just to your point about sort of treatment patterns, I like to do that same. I like to PRP one eye and inject the other and then bring them back a week and do the opposite. And I like to do it relatively early, at least getting in some PRP. I actually felt like the article on loss of follow-up was sort of enlightening as far as just sort of the consistency across AMD, PDR, DME, that you're getting this, a quarter of patients just don't come back. I thought that was sort of interesting because those are completely different patient populations. But when you look at the outcomes, the visual acuity outcomes, I'll sort of throw that aside and out because there's more DME in the patients treated with injections, but the anatomical outcomes actually were interesting to me, especially with the 20% needing TRD repair when they came back in. So I think that definitely makes me even more inclined to treat earlier with PRP laser, because I do think that, you know, especially if you sort of are thinking, all right, a quarter of these patients are coming back, it also makes me think I'm missing some patients that aren't coming back too. As far as how I do the laser, the protocol S, I think, you know, part of that is when they went and did sort of histological analysis, the Pascal laser tends to contract and the argon laser tends to spread. So a 300 spot size with argon is not the same as a 300 Pascal spot size that you end up with, especially once you start calculating the area that sort of gets exponentially more area that's covered with an argon. So I do argon laser. I do mostly slit lamp here. And that's just because we have that more at our offices. We have one office that has LAO. So I mostly do slit lamp PRP with argon. But sort of what Ali said, I do find that when I add additional anti-VEGF, as opposed to before where I was putting in 1,000 to 2,000 spots, now I'm averaging more like 500 to 800 spots before I feel like there's good regression and things look really stable over time.
Yeah, I tend to do the same. I mean, everyone has different patterns. I do a lot of slit lamp and I start with the Pascal. And like Ali said, maybe we don't need that same dense PRP. We don't know with anti-VEGF, and maybe that's where you can still get pretty good outcomes. I mean, I think the other fascinating thing, and I've talked about this before, and we've talked about this before, this is like one of the results from Protocol W or any of these studies, is like there still is a very small but real percentage in every one of these clinical trials of patients who get anti-VEGF and still have PDR, NV, vitreous hemorrhage. And I think I don't need to beat a dead horse by bringing that up or be depressing about it, but I just think it's at least for me, it's something important to remember. And I think it's important for anyone who's in training to remember, is like none of this stuff is binary. It's like we always expect that if you inject someone, their NV will go away. And if you inject someone, you're covered for an X amount of time and then they won't have bleeding events. And yes, you have significantly reduced all of those things by injecting them to a huge, huge degree, you know, 90% and up. But even in the time period where you'd expect some durability from that drug, there are still some patients who will bleed and have events. And it's just important to recognize that and not be befuddled by it, because there is a small percentage of patients who simply don't respond. I mean, we did a recent journal club where we talked about NVD and how NVD, if it's present, just doesn't regress the same way as NVE. And it's really fascinating. That's from Clarity, a postdoc analysis. Ali, any final thoughts on PDR and laser? Anything else related to this subject?
No, I think Protocol S, I think the nice thing is it just gave people more options to think about. So I think, you know, everybody's patient population is a little different, and you can find something that works for you, which I think is nice in a way. So I use a combination. That's what works for me. But I could see where different parts or different training settings, you know, you would differ your approach. And I think luckily, they all get you to the same spot as long as you keep people coming back. So actually, the first thing I tell people is no matter what we do, the worst thing that can happen is you not show up. And that's kind of what I think the loss to follow-up studies really can give you data to back up. So you can actually tell patients, look, these are the patients who didn't come back and this is what happened. So I think that actually is part of my spiel now when initially talking to PDR patients about treatment, regardless of whether it's anti-VEGF or laser.
I think that just sort of to that point, because I think that's such an important point, is that when you look at these trials, even if they were only getting, you know, however many, you know, 9 injections or however many injections over the first year, they were still being followed monthly. So if you have a patient, so some patients only required 4 injections, but some required, you know, monthly injections, and you have to follow the patient every month to determine which bin your patient goes in. So even though the mean number of injections in something like Clarity is only 4, that doesn't mean that patients need 4 injections. And I think that's a really tough part to explain to patients, to set expectations of what the follow-up is going to be if you're going to go with an injection protocol. One thing that I do think is worth noting in this paper, because they make a point about the increase in anti-VEGF, I've also found that there's an increase in the amount of wide field FAs that we're doing. And so we're picking up a lot more low risk PDR and treating it as opposed to high risk PDR, where we sort of are more inclined to do PRP laser. And so I think times where I tend more to hold off on PRP are in patients, especially ones that are recently diagnosed, starting to get their sugars under control, low risk PDR. Those are the ones where, you know, and they seem like they have good compliance, where I'll treat exclusively with injections for a while to see if that's going to hold them. But that's not normally what I do.
And I've referenced this before. I feel like the handful of patients I've done that in, this is all anecdotal. There's no science behind this. They still have eventually needed, quote unquote, needed PRP. So like, and that's over long-term follow-up over a couple of years, or people, again, like who fall in that category you were talking about. This last article has nothing to do with what we've been talking about, but I think it's interesting. And I think it's going to be a subject that we've talked about a ton. We're going to continue to talk about a ton. And again, beat a dead horse, but it's going to be more and more relevant, which is about the port delivery system. And we'll have disclosures listed. I mean, I'll be open with my disclosures. I've consulted for Regeneron. And by the time this podcast comes out, ironically, I would have consulted for Genentech because they have an ad board this weekend I'm on. And this will release after that. Though I think that's about faricimab, not about PDS. But But my point is, so again, John Kitchens wrote this article with his fellow Shivani Reddy. I think this is actually a very helpful article. It'll be more helpful once PDS is available on the market, which we expect it to be approved soon. Again, for listeners who are not familiar, port delivery system is this implantable but reservoir. It's been studied in two major trials. First, the ladder study, you know, the archway study, looking at it for neovascular AMD. And the benefit is a surgical procedure. You implant this, it gets refilled, is that it decreases the need for frequent injections to the point where you may only need to refill this every few months to, you know, beyond a year in some patients, right? So that's obviously a huge benefit in terms of treatment burden for these patients who may often need treatment monthly. So the real question is, how is this going to be implemented? And this is a great article because it kind of goes stepwise through pearls, kind of like we talk about pearls for other procedures like a sutured IOL or a buckle or whatever, and says, hey, this is what you do at this step to avoid problems. This is what you do at this step to avoid problems. And they go through all the things. And all these things are based on the complications that are reported for PDS in the studies, which are the things retina specialists are going to worry about. Vitreous hemorrhage or retinal detachment, but really the critical ones, blebs or conjurosions and ophthalmitis. Like those are the things that, you know, Dr. Flynn, who was Sarah Mine's mentor, is going to be like, you know, freaking out and maybe appropriately so, because that is a long-term risk with any sort of implantable device. So I like this article and I'm curious your guys' thoughts, but, and you can talk about anything you saw in the article that was interesting. I just think the interesting debate that we're going to have is, which patients are we actually going to take? So let's say PDS gets approved June 2021. I don't know if that's good timing, but it's too, actually we're in May. It's not going to get approved in June, but let's say it gets approved this summer, Sarah. When is the first time you're going to take a patient? Which patient will it be? Let's assume it's coded and you can bill for it. Let's assume that you get reimbursement. Those are not the issues. What is your ideal patient for the PDS to start?
Yeah. Well, so first I would just say, in looking at the PDS for people who haven't done it before, so you're making a 3.5 millimeter incision. It's pretty big. And initially they just did it as a stab incision and had about a 50% vitreous hemorrhage rate. So the side effects were pretty significant, but then they came up with this new protocol where you do a cut down and then you laser at the pars plana and do all this stuff to really try to get a tight fit. And they've gotten the incidence of the vitreous hemorrhage down to about 6%. So there's still a significant vitreous hemorrhage risk. And then when you look at sort of the adverse events, like you were talking about, at least in the archway trial, the endophthalmitis is 1.6%, RD is 0.8%, not even including conj blebs. Then they also had three that dislocated. So if you take all comers of potentially blinding complications, that's 9 out of 248 patients, so that's 3.8%. So I think sort of going into your patient selection, you have to say, when I do this surgery, there's a chance that there's a blinding complication of endophthalmitis, RD, or an extrusion of the implant itself that's getting up close to 4%. And so because of that, I think that sort of limits the patients that you're thinking about doing the surgery in. When I think about diabetes, I often think of it as having an active period over 1 to 4 years. And we see this looking at protocol I, RISE, RIDE, protocol S, sort of over and over again. We see patients who need injections in year one, and then it goes down dramatically year two, and then continues to go down year after year. And so that's where I think it's hard to sort of think about an implant in a disease that perhaps you're really only looking at treatment for 1 to 3 years, and then maybe just a little bit of maintenance after that. And so I think really the place where this is going to shine is in macular degeneration, and especially in patients who have trouble coming in or who are getting monthly injections every single month. That's where I think this is potentially a really great device. And that's the patient that I would be looking to implant it in, is an active patient who has good response to medication, requires monthly injections.
Is there, and before I ask Ali, is there an age cutoff for you, Sarah? Like, is it better if they're younger because their conj is better? Is it better if they're older because you don't need to depend on the conj to last as long for the reservoir? I mean, do you have anything in your head for that?
No, I would say, I would actually almost say the inverse. Like if they're an older patient, there's potentially less. I mean, if you put this in a patient who's 60, they have maybe 35 years with this implant in the eye.
Right.
I think lot more chance you're going to run into trouble than maybe a 92-year-old. And so you can kind of trust, you know, the 72-week data to sort of maybe cover you and to be able to extrapolate for that. I would say that I would be maybe a little bit more anxious in a younger patient where you really don't know what's going to happen in 2 decades.
Right. Ali, how about you? Is there an ideal patient for you? Are you going to sit back and let Sarah redo it first and then call her and be like, how did it go? And 6 months later, then think about, I'm just curious about, I'm always curious about everyone's threshold for new implementation of a device or a drug. So, and this is the question, I'm sure if there's someone from Genentech listening, they're listening closely, even though this is N of 3, like what would be your threshold to put a patient on this, assuming there's no reimbursement issues?
Yeah, I think first, I agree with the strategy of letting Sarah go first and letting me know how that goes. but outside of that, I think Sarah is right. We don't have a ton of experience yet. So I think everyone's kind of, molded by their own experiences when they're the surgeon. And you would think, part of the strategy could be people who I worry about loss to follow up and aren't going to be able to come back. So that could be a young diabetic, or that could be an older AMD patient based on the loss to follow-up studies. The converse is, similar to what we talked about with secondary IOLs and Gore-Tex, like we don't have 10-year data on this stuff. And are we going to find a bunch of weird late complications from these devices? Would that change my opinion on a younger patient? But again, a lot of these younger patients with diabetics tend to need less treatment over time. So I think I'm probably going to start with AMD patients rather than diabetic patients to kind of get my bearings. The age and sort of surgical ability based on comorbid diseases is going to come in to my, decision-making process if I think they're safe for surgery or not. And that's probably kind of how I will start. But I don't think I'm going to have like a cutoff or something necessarily in my head going at the start, but we'll try to choose a few patients I think are quote unquote ideal for my own practice. And once I get my own feeling for it, then probably expand from there, which I think is true of adopting, most new techniques or new technology. So that's kind of how I think about it right now. I think there's going to be a lot to work on in terms of OR access and reimbursement and that sort of thing first. And that might end up limiting people to certain patients to start with. And that might give us a little bit of a runway to get through the learning curve and go from there.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And just a couple of qualifiers. First of all, we don't know if it's going to be approved both for AMD and DME at the same time. We don't have the DME trial data. So you guys both referenced diabetes, which I think is reasonable because you would assume that if the AMD indication comes, the DME indication will come soon after. But there are kind of like basically, there are three things I think about when I think about PDS with everything you guys said. The first thing is, in terms of patient selection, is counseling these patients. I have found neovascular AMD patients to be relatively risk averse when I talk to them versus diabetic patients. And I really think that's an age thing. For example, for brolucizumab, I have some patients who I've counseled on brolucizumab and talked to them about risks and benefits. And they all routinely, even if I quote a 1 in a few 100 rate, are like, I don't wanna do that. And so I wonder if you actually, and again, phraseology and informed consent is like, everything, right? You can say, oh, it's only a really rare risk, or you can be like, it's 1 out of 20, and or serious is 4%, 1 out of 25. And that sounds very, very different depending on how you phrase it. But I just wonder how many of my AMD patients, if I tell them, hey, there's a 4% risk or 1 in 25, they're going to be like, you know what? I just want to stay with the injections. And so that may also limit, like you said, Ali, the patients who actually are willing to do it. The second thing I think about is, what do you do in terms of managing complications? I always think it's curious, right? So like, if, and I don't mean to be negative, but I'm just saying, like, if you did have a PDS that developed a retinal detachment, like, what does that mean? Does that mean you can't place a buckle anymore in this patient? Probably you should not. And can you open the conj and reclose it? Should you just be doing transconjunctival and suturing your ports? Like, what does it mean in terms of your gas fill? How does it work with oil if you need to use oil? I mean, I would assume all those things are probably not big deals because we have some experience with pars plana tubes and tamponade. But these are the things I would think about because we don't actually have any experience. We don't have any of this reported from the trials, what they did with those RD patients, for example, and how those RD patients did. And then endophthalmitis is another example. Like if they do get endophthalmitis, if it's early, do you take the implant out? Probably. But what if it's late related to refill? Do you have to take the implant out? Can you leave it? Is it like a tube where it's at that point, if it's infected and that was the route of infection, you should get rid of it? Or is it simply seeding from when you pass the needle? Like I'm sure it'll be case-based, but we don't have rules or algorithms to assess this. Are you going to be looking for a blebitis over the ground? I mean, I'm just thinking about what sort of things we're going to be teaching our residents or our fellows in terms of how to assess this. And we don't even know yet because we haven't seen these problems yet. And then the third thing I think about is in terms of applicability, I always think we should always strive for the highest standard for every single retinal surgeon. But I feel like any procedure, once you start adding more and more steps that require meticulous steps, unfortunately, there's going to be attrition when you start applying this in the general community. And that really makes me think, what will be the actual footprint or impact of PDS, right? So let's say you can do it and people have OR access. Ali, you referenced the OR access may limit the footprint because maybe you just can't get many of these patients to the OR. But what about the number of surgeons who are comfortable and trained to do it, right? So like, is everyone going to be doing this? But if everyone's doing it, is everyone going to maintain that same degree of quality? In which case, is it really going to be limited in terms of the impact and the positive footprint to certain places? Well, that's probably going to limit the overall footprint on a national, international scale versus can we do things to make these steps as meticulous as they are more approachable where people are able to do them and do them without essentially sacrificing steps, cutting corners and resulting in problems. Like that to me is one of the hard parts is anytime you have any procedure like a sutured IOL or a scleral fixated IOL where they're become more complicated in terms of the steps, then I think there's more chance as you start broadening its reach that there's going to be problems as more and more people do it. I don't know your thoughts, Sarah, on any of those points.
Well, I'm guessing that we may run into something similar like we with brolucizumab when we switch to real world data that there's a, if you look at the list of surgeons who do the PDS now, it's a who's who in retina. I mean, these are great surgeons at great institutions. And so you can sort of expect that they've been trained, they've been doing this a few times. And so that these rates may actually be higher once you get out into the community and once you start having the real world data. And we won't know that until the PDS sort of gets approved and becomes more broadly available. I think Genentech has been pretty careful about making sure that when people are using the PDS, that they have somebody come out and is in the room teaching the surgeon. They have a very vested interest in the surgery going well with as few complications as possible. I don't know if they're going to be able to do that for everybody across
the US. But that's my point, is if they can't do it for everyone if you want the impact that you want, because it's going to be tens of, you ideally, if it's going to change our field, it's going to have to be tens of thousands up to 100,000 patients over time. I don't know if you have enough manpower to make sure someone is in the room every single time.
Right. And I don't know if that's a cost-effective way to manage this disease, these diseases, if you think about.
Well, for Genentech, it would be, I mean, for any company, it would be, but you're right. Yeah. Yeah. What about complication management, Ali? Like, I don't want to get too far. I'm just curious. Like, these are things I think about when I see that. I was like, okay, if I have a patient who comes in with one of these, like, what would I do? I mean, I would probably be off the bat. I'd be like, I'm not going to buckle them unless I have to. Hopefully they're pseudophakic and it's a pseudophakic RD and I can just do a vitrectomy. But how is that reservoir? I mean, it shouldn't, because it has to have a valve to it. I mean, it shouldn't react differently under gas or air or on tamponade, but I just wonder, is it going to change anything? I probably would suture my sclerotomies anyway, because I tend to suture sclerotomies more of the time than not, but I'm just maybe curious.
Because if you sit temporally or you sit, maybe it's,
well, it's super temporal, but how it's temporal. 3.5 millimeters, right? So you either have to go
temporally, so that I could put my trocars at like 12.
Right. So that's my point is like, so if you're sitting superiorly and I'm gesturing my hands, even though this is an audio format.
We're both gesturing
with our hands. But if you're sitting superiorly in a 3.5 millimeter incision, then either that temporal hand has to be super low or super high to avoid that thing. Or like you said, you have to sit temporally, which I have done mostly for sutured lenses, but I would say the average retina specialist, and I'm not saying I'm above average, I'm just saying I have weird cases sometimes where I have to sit temporally. I don't think most of us have sat temporally that often. And it's not that big a deal and you adjust fast, but just things like that is there's always gonna be a stress level. It's like, oh my God, I gotta manage this complication. That now I have to do it from an approach where I'm not as familiar doing it from that approach. So I think these are things that are important to think in advance. Like if you had an RD in one of these patients, I probably would sit temporally and then put the ports kind of, maybe that those ports have to be closer to 12 and 6, and then the infusion somewhere infranasally. But Ali, I don't know what your thoughts are.
They referenced some of these points, in this article. I actually really liked reading this article because it wasn't so much like, here's the data about PDS. It was more like, all right, you got a PDS on the table. How are you going to actually get this thing in? And it read very much like some of the articles, I've tried to write in the past about sutured IOLs and that I've read about new techniques as very practical. Like,
call it, they copied your article style. This looked exactly like your top 10 tips for Gore-Tex IOLs.
Well, you know what? Honestly, when I read, like, look at the cons, I was like, you know what? You're right. You should look at the cons because, you know, just little simple, simple stuff like that. You're like, no, I'm probably not going to stick this thing in to an older patient with AMD that has really eroded cons. It doesn't make any sense. And there's sometimes stuff that you've got to think of ahead of time. You know, with secondary IOLs, you have options. With this, you don't. It's either you do it or you don't. So I think, you know, it read very practically. So I actually really enjoyed reading this article as well. You know, the managing the complications thing, I think you're right. They even talked in the article about how you probably would want to avoid a buckle. So, you know, that might, I might not do this in a myope. I might not do this in a young person with diabetes that doesn't have a PVD yet, if they did have, you know, retinal detachment. So I might think about those things. And the way I'm thinking about it, you know, positioning, like you were talking about, I'd try to think of this more like a tube shunt, try to stick this as supratemporal as possible so that if you did have an RD, you still have 3 and 9 to work with and, you know, go from there. You know, none of us really came up at the time of like the retiserts being put in a lot to kind of have a ton of experience our own selves with these kind of, you know, non-vitrectomy, but implanting a device type surgeries. So it's not really in our wheelhouse, but I feel like, you know, I would approach it similar to the hardware of a tube shunt and try from there. But, you know, I think you're right. It is sort of unknown territory. And to Sarah's point, they probably, Genentech, you know, it does have a vested interest in making sure this doesn't go poorly at the very beginning. Because, you know, I think the retina community, once they hear, oh, this is going poorly, everyone just stops and will wait till somebody else figures it out before they'll even try it again. So, you know, it might roll out slowly. And I think that's okay, because I don't think everybody needs this. And I don't think Genentech necessarily thinks everybody needs this. But it's a good option in the people who can't come back very often. And you know, your prior question about who you would choose, you know, I was thinking, you know, these patients who every time you come in for an AMD injection, they ask you every time, how many more do I have to do it? And, you know, they might be super motivated to try this. And I think, you know, those might be the people I start with first. But I think we'll only know until we try. And I remember when the early phase 1, phase 2 data came out, Carl Ruggiello was talking about this because he was involved with PDS pretty early. And, you know, he was talking about the vitreous hemorrhage and how they stopped the trial and kind of went back to the drawing board about their technique before they restarted. And, you know, I think that's to be expected with a new surgical device and a new surgical technique. And I think we'll figure that as a whole, you know, together. But this type of article, I think, is nice to have even before it's approved. So at least you're thinking about it ahead of time.
Yeah. I would say it's in just sort of jumping off the complications, because I was now thinking about the endophthalmitis, you know, because when they talk about the dislocation, they said that the sclera looked discolored.
Yeah.
In the patients. So then you wonder if you take it out, whether or not you've got this like necrotizing.
Right. Are you going to put a monster patch graft? Like, I mean, maybe we saw too many infections in Miami, but like, these are the things I'm thinking about. Is like, are you going to have like the grand rounds about like a necrotizing scleritis and then with a fungal infection that you have to graft? And, or I'm just thinking like even simple, like Ali said retisert. And the first thing, and again, this is like my psychology. The first thing I thought of, there was a case I remember as an attending here, one of my colleagues were here was telling me where a retisert, they went to remove it and it broke. And like the device component fell into the eye. It broke off of the tab. And then they had to retrieve it. And it was like a disaster to retrieve this thing. And then closure. And like, then I was just like, could the reservoir break? Like if you didn't handle it right when you're trying to remove it and it's necrotic, like, there's going to be a video one day at like ASRS or one of these meetings of like, or BBS. Like, anyway, I hope that none of those things happen. I just think it's interesting to start thinking about what we do when that does happen, because no one was expecting complications from brolucizumab when it hit the market. And then patients were rolling into the ER at Bascom, Wills, and other big places with these problems. And you're like, what is going on? And hopefully we don't see any of this, but we actually know that there are complications here. So the question is like, if it does happen, what do you do? If they have vitreous hemorrhage, I assume you B-scan them, you wait, you let it clear, and then hopefully it clears on its own, like it did in the study. And endophthalmitis, antibiotics, plus or minus a vitrectomy, plus or minus removing it, RD, some sort of vitrectomy to repair it. But again, I would be really curious to talk to the people in the studies who manage those complications. What, like, that would be like a good paper to publish at some point, would be, yeah. how did we manage the complications of the PDS, right? And we probably won't see that until it's on the market, because no one wants to talk about the bad stuff till post-market. But like, that would actually be very helpful for the random retina specialist in poor, you know, middle of America, who just, this patient wanders in on a Friday night and they're like, oh my God, what do I have to do now? So,
but I also think to Ali's point, like, at the end of the day, there are complications with this, and those complications are being, you know, those are being improved all the time. The technique is being improved, but this is a technique that does work very well. You know, if you look at the Archway data, this is a device that dramatically decreases the need for injections in these patients. And so there are patients with macular degeneration where maybe it's their worst seeing eye and they're coming in for injections all the time, where, you know, really, even though there are some risks, the benefits far outweigh them for that right. particular patient. So I do think patient selection is really important. There are patients that this is even now is going to be good for. And then hopefully, you know, as the technique continues to improve and these complications sort of go down, hopefully, that'll just sort of expand. But
well, guys, I appreciate you guys taking the time. We went way over. We're going to be releasing this podcast June 1st, 2021. Last quick thing, NBA playoffs started tonight with play-in games. Ali is a diehard Lakers fan. Sarah should be a Celtics fan, but I don't think she cares very much about basketball. Ali,
I used to care a lot about basketball, but that was when I didn't have a newborn. Now I just care about trying to sleep.
Very fair. Ali has two kids and he still cares, which means he has a really, really great wife. So Ali, Lakers, we were talking about before the podcast, go on the record. Lakers play the play-in game tomorrow against the Warriors. After that, then they have to move on. And, you know, depending on that, they, you know, maybe play another play-in game, go into the playoffs. What are your expectations for the Lakers? And would you rather play the Suns or the Jazz right now, understanding this will release when they're in the middle of a series with one of those teams?
I would say I'm watching all these games after 9 p.m. Eastern time, so I understand Sarah. secondly, you know, I think it's I like being the underdog this year as a Lakers fan. I think nobody knows, including Lakers fans themselves, who's injured, who's not injured, who's going to figure it out, and who's going to walk off the court injured or not injured again. But I just hope we get through the Warriors, and so we don't have to play another game because that's too nervous. And I think it'd be fun to play the Suns just because I like Devin Booker. And I think they will not underestimate Chris Paul. So they'll bring their A game and not play down. But, you know, honestly, at this point, I just want them to not be injured. And if whatever works for that, I'm good with.
Yeah. And my last question for you is, if the Lakers don't win the title, who are you rooting for?
You know, I'm in Philly now, but it's not going to be the Sixers, and it's not going to be
so harsh.
Not going to be the Clippers. So I don't know. It's a good question. I think I would pick a team that you know, has not had a history of winning, and is kind of you know, sort of coming up, and maybe deserves a chance to actually get some credit here. So maybe in the East. Maybe the Bucks. Giannis won't be a flame out. And for the West, I think Chris Paul deserves a title. And I like Devin Booker. So the Suns, if they're not the Lakers.
And I'm going to go on the record and say I think the Lakers are going to win the title, unfortunately. And I'm okay with that as long as the Nets don't win the title. That would be my worst case scenario, would be the Nets beating the Lakers, because that would just be horrible. But I will let you guys go. Thank you so much for your time, and I will see you guys next time.
Bye, Jay. Thank you.
As always, you can find this podcast episode and all other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. It's RETINAPodcast.com. All 296 episodes are there, sorted by category. In addition, you will find a link to subscribe and receive email updates on the latest episodes so they can hit your inbox. I prefer to get my updates using the subscription off my mobile device. Apple Podcasts and Android Podcasts have the podcast there for searching. You can find us on social media, Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And you can always contact us by clicking the contact us link on our website or emailing us directly to retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you, hearing fresh perspectives, hearing ideas and things we are doing better.
things we can continue to improve on, things you want to hear about in the future. Many thanks to Drs. Sarah Parker, Reed Choi, and Ali Khan for joining me for this podcast episode. Thanks again to the whole team here at Retina Podcast. That includes Angela Chang, Mike Venacasa, and Louis Kai. Thank you, listeners, for the patients you take care of on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.